Well, hey, good morning. It is so good to see you today. This is week three of our series called Just Saying. We're talking about the power of our words, the reality that the things that we say, sometimes we are tempted to say, oh, it's not that big a deal. And there are certain areas of our speech we know maybe isn't the best, but we kind of play it off as not all that important. And what we've been looking at is the reality that what we say is incredibly important. It has a huge impact on the people around us. And more than that, what we say, we looked about at this a couple of weeks ago, is a reflection of our hearts. And today I want to talk a little bit about grumbling and complaining. And grumbling and complaining, as we just said, it's one of those things where we might say, it's not that big a deal. I know I probably shouldn't complain, but I do. And it's maybe not that big a deal. But if we dive deeper, we know that it is something that is a reflection of our heart, and that makes it a big deal. It means there's something inside of us that is negative that we need to deal with. And we might like to think, when we complain, that we're complaining because of everything out here. We talked about this, the same with gossip, and we say we do it because of our circumstances. We do it because of something somebody else said, something somebody else did, something somebody did to me, the way I've been treated by somebody else. And so I'm complaining, but it's only because of my circumstances or because of somebody else. It's something wrong out here in the world. But I know that when it comes to complaining, it's actually something that comes from in here. It's something that comes from our heart. I'll tell you why. Because when it comes to complaining, we're always moving the goalposts. We're always moving the standard. The things that we complain about, the circumstances, when they change, we find something else to complain about and we continue to complain, don't we? So you complain when you're single that you're lonely. And then you get married and you complain about your spouse. You complain in the winter that it's too cold. And then in the middle of the summer, it gets too hot. You complain when you wish that you had a house, and then you get a house, you start complaining that there's too much to maintain. You complain when you don't have a job, and then you get one and you complain about how much you have to work. And we're all overworked and underpaid, amen? The reality is we're always finding something to complain about, and we live in this cycle sometimes of feeling like, I need something better, I'm entitled to something more, I want something different, and then when we get that, there's something else to complain about, and what it shows is it's really not our set of circumstances, even though we would acknowledge there are oftentimes legitimate things that are going wrong that we complain about because they're not the way that it should be. But the fact that we complain shows that there's something wrong inside of us. There's something off kilter inside of us, because even when we get that, we find something else and we find something else, and we just move the goalposts and we continue to complain. Because complaints are good at identifying the things in our lives that we wish were different and that sometimes really should and ought to be different. But complaining's not so good at replacing those things with something better. We look at our lives and the story of our lives and we say, this isn't the story that I want, or this part of the story isn't what I want. But complaining isn't very good at replacing that story with something better, with a better narrative about who we are, what we're doing. So today I want to take a few minutes for us to talk about complaining, to identify some of that inside of us, and then to take that narrative, the story that leads us to complain, we'll talk about that in a minute, and to replace it with a far better story. First, I just want to take a few minutes, and I'm hopefully can offend everybody a little bit here, and I want to talk about the ways that we complain, and I'm going to give you four different kind of people that complain, that when you complain, maybe this is you, and I hope that somewhere in here, you'll just, maybe a light will go off, and you'll say, oh yeah, when I complain, that's me, because some of us, maybe all of us are complainers, but some of us complain differently. There's lots of ways of expressing it, so here's a bunch of ways that we complain, or different kinds of complainers that you might see yourself in a little bit. First, there's the whiner. This is the person that just says, life isn't fair. You wake up every day and you're negative. I don't want to do that. I wish we didn't have to go through this. You rise and whine instead of rise and shine. There's just always something wrong. Life is not fair. And I wish I didn't have to do this. And I wish they didn't do that to me. Then secondly, there's the martyr. or the victim mentality. There's the person who I'm always a product of what everybody else has done for me, and we want the attention that comes from letting everybody know how hard off we have it, how tough things are for, and you don't know the things that people have done to me, and I'm always trying to help other people and they're not reciprocating, and I'm just always at the bottom of the heap and I can't get ahead and all the things that are happening to me. And we love the attention that comes from being the victim, the person that's never being treated right. We're always just the martyr. Woe is me. Third, we have the pessimist. And nothing's ever going to change. We are doomed. This is just how it is, and it is bad. And the pessimist complains about the culture, the government, the schools, everything around. It's just everything is on a downward spiral. There's no good anywhere, and there's really no hope for things to get better. This is just how it is. We are doomed to sit around and complain about what everybody else is doing and about the world around us, about how things are going. And then fourth, we have the snob. Nothing's ever good enough for me. I deserve better. I know I have this, but I need the newer one. And I wish I had this. And I think that we're entitled to something more. And why do we have to put up with this? And that's not good enough for me. It's the snob that feels entitled, like we deserve more, like we shouldn't have to endure with what we have and where we're at in life. And probably for most of us, we find ourselves maybe a combination of those four things, and maybe there's one that rises to the surface where when we are tempted to complain, we fall in one of these categories. We whine, we're the victim or the martyr, we're so pessimistic, just kind of snobby. And I think one of the things that our culture has done for us is our culture has told us over and over and over that we are entitled, that we do deserve more. In fact, our culture has oftentimes wanted to prove to us that we are consumers. We live in a society where it's a drive-through culture, right? We start to believe somewhere in our head that we should be able to drive in, order what we want, and then get it. And if it takes more than 3 minutes, we're offended because we deserve more. This is what you're here for. You're here to serve me. And it's one thing if you're a consumer and you walk into a mall, you go into a store, you go into a restaurant, and people are paid there to serve you. You can get away with it a little bit because that's what that system is all predicated on. But when you take that consumer mentality into your family, into your workplace, into friendships, your spiritual life, and you're expecting that mentality of entitlement and what I deserve and I should get better to be the way that your paradigm works for relationships, you find that doesn't work at all. The consumer mentality is not going to lead to a strong marriage or a great family or wonderful friendships or a deep spiritual life, that all of a sudden all that's going to crumble. But we buy into the myth sometimes that says that consumerism, entitlement, is going to lead us to happiness. That if I just get that, if I have a little bit more, and that's what I deserve, and that's the kind of life that I have, and if I get that, I'm going to be happy. But what I want to share with you today, what I believe, and you don't have to be a religious person to believe this principle, I think you'll find this to be true if you just think about your life long enough, and if you look at the way that you live and your attitude towards different things, I think you'll find this to be true, that entitlement leads to discontentment. When you start to believe that you are entitled to more, that you deserve more, that you deserve a better life or more stuff or people to treat you differently, that entitlement actually leads to discontentment rather than satisfaction. Because entitlement tries to reel us in and say, yeah, but you deserve this, because if you get it, you're going to be happier. You're going to be satisfied. It's going to work for you. And that's tempting. And in some ways, that makes a lot of sense to us logically. Except what I encourage you to do today is think through this. And I'm not going to tell you that, well, that's just wrong and you shouldn't believe it because it's morally reprehensible. I'm here to tell you this morning that I just don't think it works. It's not practical. It may not be moral either, but I don't think it's practical because I don't think it works. Entitlement means that you start to believe that you deserve more. And you start to live that way. You deserve more from the people in your family. You deserve more from the people around you, more from the people at work. You deserve, 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 deserve. And then people don't live up, and your experiences don't live up, and you find that there's a dead end there. You come to discontentment. You aren't really happy at all. And this actually just drives the cycle around and round, because you find you're discontented, and then you think that you're entitled to better, and you seek after that better, but then you're left feeling discontent, and then you feel like you're entitled to more, and you just go around and around in this cycle trying to find the satisfaction and happiness. But that attitude and that drive that comes from "you deserve this, you deserve this, you deserve this" never really pays off. And again, don't take my word for it. Just think about your life. Think about your experiences. Think about how you treat people and where that mindset might crop in. Maybe it's one of those four categories where you whine or you feel like the martyr, you're pessimistic or you're snobby, and you go, does that really lead me to where I think it's going to lead? Does it really lead me to where I think it promises? And if not, if part of you goes, yeah, I'm not sure that that does work, then I want you to follow me through the rest of this message as we talk through this, because I think we can replace that story, that narrative, and the attitude that goes alongside of it, and that we can replace it with something so much better. In fact, today, if you are not a Christian, you're just listening along and following in, today I want to tell you something about God that Christians believe to be true that I don't think you will find in any other philosophy or religion. I think it is something that is unique to Christianity, and it will completely blow you away. It'll be something that probably nobody's ever told you before about God. And if you are a follower of Jesus today, and this is what you've accepted, and that you were you've given your life to Christ, I hope that you'll be encouraged by that very same thing, and to maybe pull you back on track as we look at the story that all of us have of discontentment that manifests itself oftentimes as we complain and as we verbally express that we deserve better, we deserve more in some areas. So if you have a Bible or a phone, an app on your phone, we're in Philippians chapter 2. Philippians is a letter written by the Apostle Paul, early pioneer of the church. He planted a number of churches, and then after left, he would often write back and sometimes correct them on things, sometimes write back to encourage them and make sure that they're still on track or to help get them back on track. And that's the letter of Philippians to people who live in Philippi. And in Philippians chapter 2, verse 14, it starts like this. He says, "Do everything without complaining and arguing." That is the what of this message. Well, what are we talking about? What do? Do everything without complaining and arguing. This is not a complicated statement. This is a straightforward. You don't need me to parse all the words and explain everything to you. This is just straightforward. Do everything you do without complaining and arguing. But what we've seen in this series is that we're not just coming and saying, hey, you need to hold your tongue. You need to be in better self-control. Because some of us have tried that. And to be honest, it's too hard. We can't always do it. And so we want to dive deeper, as we have been every week, and say that what we say, and sometimes in our complaints and our arguments, what comes out of our mouth is a reflection of something deeper going on, something on the heart level that we need to dive into and dig into to make sure that we're dealing with it on a deeper level. So this is the what: do everything without complaining and arguing. Now, if you will with me, we're going to dive deeper and figure out how we actually address that issue. So verse 15 says, "Why? So that no one can criticize you. Live clean, innocent lives as children of God, shining like bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people." Now, I told you that the Apostle Paul wrote this letter. The Apostle Paul was a Jewish man who was embedded in his religious institution of the day. He was a scholar, a rabbi, a teacher. He would have known the Jewish scriptures, our Old Testament, inside and out. He would have the whole thing memorized. He would know all of its stories and all of its particular points extremely, extremely well. And his writers, a lot of them would have picked, or his readers that read the letter originally, would have picked up a lot on that. And when Paul writes these few verses that we've already read, he is alerting them to a story that all of them would have understood and all of them would have known that he knew well. In fact, he uses a number of phrases and terms that are picked right out of that story so that when they read it, they would go, oh yeah, I remember this story. It is perhaps the most important and powerful story in the history of the Jewish people. It's the story of the Exodus. If you go back into the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, you can read about the Exodus through there and everything that happens after that in those first few books of the Bible. It is an incredible story. It goes like this. The Israelites are in Egypt. They are in bondage. They are enslaved. They are living terrible, terrible lives. They believe that they were the children of God. Paul wrote that, actually, speaking of Christians in this verse that we just read. Be children of God. This is who you're supposed to be. You're supposed to live as children of God. Well, the Israelites were the children of God, and yet living in terrible, terrible circumstances, the kind of circumstances where you would certainly complain about. and you had reason to complain about them. You were a slave. You had no freedom, no rights, treated terribly, forced to do the work of the Egyptians. Until one day God comes to Moses and says, Moses, you're going to be the leader of this people, and I'm going to lead them out of slavery, out of Egypt, and towards the promised land, and I'm going to give them the blessing of this promised land. Goes all the way back to the promises to the ancestor, Abram. God said, I'm going to bless you so you can be a blessing, and I'm going to give you this land so that you can experience my blessing and be a blessing to the world. And so Moses goes to Pharaoh, and you understand how that would go from Pharaoh. Hey, let my people go. And he says, no. And God brings on a series of plagues of these terrible things that happen to the Egyptians one after another, and they keep going with the request, let my people go, let my people go, and it doesn't happen. Until the very last plague, it just escalates to this point, and the plague that will come upon Egypt is the death of the firstborn. That death will reach all the houses, and the firstborn son in each household will die. And the Israelites, believing that the children of God, would take a lamb, sacrifice it, and they would take the blood, put it on their post of their door to say, we are the children of God, so that they would be exempt from that plague. And when that plague comes on the people of Egypt, you could just imagine how devastating it is, to the point where Pharaoh says, get these people out of here, get out. And so Moses takes all of these people, just thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and they start marching out of Egypt. And as they get, on the outskirts, and they're going, they get to the Red Sea, and it's this big sea that they have to get to the other side. And at this point, as they've come out of Egypt, you know, Pharaoh's changing his mind and saying, we got to go after them. And so the army's coming behind them, and you just see this terrible moment happening, about to happen. And so God, through Moses, splits the sea so that they can walk through it on dry ground. And this huge group of people, Israelites, walk through the sea on dry ground with the walls of water on both sides. And then when they get to the other side, it all collapses in so that they can't be chased and that they can be free and they get out there. It is the hugest story for the Israelite people. It is this miraculous moment in their history, in the history of their people, where everybody goes, this is the most powerful thing we've seen God do. This is just absolutely incredible. Could you imagine going through something like that? And then they get to the other side, and it doesn't take long before they realize that now they're in a desert, and it's hot. And they start complaining. We're thirsty. Where's the water? That's legitimate. You're in the desert. You need water. We're hungry. Where's the food? The Exodus after that becomes like the biblical version of a family road trip. We're hungry. We're thirsty. Are we lost? Are we there yet? Come on. Let's just go back. They actually say to Moses, we wish that we were back in Egypt. We wish we were slaves again, because at least we knew where our next meal was coming from. You go, what? You just crossed over the Red Sea and the waters parted. You walked on dry land. God miraculously took you out of slavery and into freedom. And then all of a sudden, in a relatively short amount of time, you're sitting there going, oh, we're hungry. And then God provides for them meat at night that they just have to go out and gather, miraculously there for them, and bread in the morning that they just have to gather. Day after day, it's just there and they get it. And we don't really like this stuff. And they grumble, and they complain. And when Paul writes this in Philippians, children of God, live as children of God. Don't do anything with complaining and arguing. Everybody who read that would go, oh yeah, just like the Exodus. In fact, in Exodus 16, this is an example. This is Moses and Aaron. They're the leaders at the time, and people are grumbling and complaining. So Moses and Aaron, this is Exodus 16, verse 6. You don't need to turn there, but follow along with me. Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he's heard you grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us? So Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Isn't God just, why are you complaining? Isn't God giving you what you need in the evening and in the morning? You're complaining about us. You're complaining about your leadership. Then he says this powerful thing at the end. Your grumbling's not against us, but against the Lord. Whoa. Isn't God giving you what you need? And this isn't good for you? He led you out of slavery, and now you're upset at where you just moved the goalpost. The grass is always greener. When you're in Egypt, we just need to get out. When you're out of Egypt, we wish we could go back. grumbling and complaining. You go, man, this people saw God do something so powerful and miraculous. How, in such a short amount of time, can they be grumbling and complaining? How could they do that? And you might think, that's almost hard to believe that they could do that. But that's not the hard to believe part of this story. Do you know what is? The hard to believe part of this story is that this is our story. This is us. When you see how much God has done and how much God has provided for you, and you find a way to complain, and then you get something and you complain about something else and complain about something, it's not hard to believe that they did that, because the hard thing to believe is, oh, that's me, that's what I do. And when you read about somebody else, you go, how could they do that? Until you realize, wait a second, this story is a story of the Israelites, but why has this story been such a powerful story for thousands and thousands of years? Why did this story make it to 2017 and people are still reading it? Because that's my story too, and that's your story too, isn't it? You're just moving the goalposts. You still find something to grumble and complain about. When Paul wrote back in Philippians chapter 2, that you're to shine like stars in a crooked and twisted generation. So sometimes we read that and say, okay, I get it. So we're supposed to live as children of God, good people, in a world where everybody else is not so good. Everybody else is twisted and perverse. The crooked and twisted generation, that's actually, again, it's a specific phrase ripped out of the Exodus story, but later in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 32:5. Is kind of God calling out his people. And he's actually looking at a generation, the generation that had come out of Egypt and seen God do all these powerful things. Same generation that started complaining and kept complaining and complaining and complaining. And it showed where their faith level was, that they would just easily lose faith in what God was doing and say, I want to go back there. I'm entitled to more. I want a better life, even though God was gearing them towards his blessing. And God calls them a crooked and twisted generation, Deuteronomy 32:5. This is a crooked and twisted generation. I thought they were the children of God. Yeah, then how could they be complaining so much? Well, they're so twisted. And Paul picks up on that, and he's not saying, listen, you're supposed to live differently than everybody else in the world, as true as that might be. He's saying a crooked and twisted generation is speaking to a people of faith who became entitled. Remember the generation of people that wandered out of Egypt, led by Moses and God's powerful hand, and they become twisted and perverse. They forgot what God was doing for them almost right away. Don't call yourselves children of God and then live as a perverse generation. You now be a different generation that will live differently in and amongst people who consider themselves children of God. What about shine like stars? You're supposed to shine like stars. That's saying essentially, remember that you're part of an unselfish mission. You were always called to be something that was bigger, part of something that was bigger than you. Just like the Israelites were called to be a blessing as they were blessed. Use whatever God has blessed you with in order to bless the world. And part of that blessing was the promise they would go to the promised land. And in that land, from there, they would bless the whole world. And instead, they became entitled and they started complaining, saying, we deserve better. God's blessing. I don't see God's blessing. Take me back to Egypt. At least there is hot food there. What? Oh, you're supposed to shine like stars. Part of the promise to Abraham was that his descendants would be as many as the stars of the sky. You wouldn't be able to count them. There'd be so many stars. And it's what Jesus picked up on when he looked at his disciples. He said, children of God, I want you to shine. I want you to be a light, the light of the world. Shining. Think of it in an ancient culture. I mean, stars are a big deal to us, especially if you get outside the city and there's less light here and you just see how they light things up. But think of a culture that has no electricity, no nighttime lights, nothing that you can just flip on at night. It just gets dark, really, really pitch dark, except for when you see the stars on a clear night that light up the landscape. That's what you're supposed to be like. And you're called to be something bigger than yourself, to shine like stars. To be the light of the world, to be God's light in darkness. How can you do that when you're just complaining, saying you deserve better? You wish there was something else. It's hard to imagine that these people would complain so much. And Paul is just bringing that story to the light of people and saying, you're children of God. Don't get it twisted. Shine like stars that God has called you to shine like. So verse 16, back in Philippians chapter 2, he says, hold firmly. If you got a Bible, circle that, hold firmly. On your app, make sure you highlight that. Just right now, just put a circle and come back to that in a second. Hold firmly. Or some of your translations might say, hold fast. Like, take both hands and grip onto the word of life that is Jesus, his teaching, his example. Hold, grab on and don't let go. Then on the day of Christ's return, I will be proud that I did not run the race in vain and that my work was not useless. Paul's now talking about his influence on them and saying, this is everything. This is what makes it worthwhile. Don't let go of Jesus. But I will rejoice even if I lose my life, pouring it out like a liquid offering to God, just like your faithful service is an offering to God. And I want all of you to share that joy. Yes, you should rejoice, and I will share your joy. Paul, when he wrote this letter, understand, Paul had things to complain about. He wrote this letter from prison. Beaten, arrested, imprisoned. And from prison, he sends this letter to them and says, don't complain. And subtext, I have things to complain about. If you could complain about things, I can complain about things. I'm in jail. But don't complain. Listen, even more, because he's now breaking that cycle that says you're entitled to something and you think if you get it, you'll be happy. He goes to joy a different way. He says, hold firmly to Jesus. Grab onto him because that's what makes all this worthwhile. Even if I have to give my life, even if I die for this cause, I would die. That's how much this means to me. And then he says, just like your faithful service, I want to be like a liquid offering to God. Or some of your translations might say a drink offering to God. That was when people went into a temple, often the pagan temples, they would take an animal, they would burn the meat, and the aroma would be like their gift to God. I'm giving you this. It was mine. I give it to you. We burn it up. And when they finished burning the portion that went to God, they would take wine and throw it on the fire. And when you throw wine on the fire with the alcohol, the fire goes, and it flares up and it gets big. Paul goes, that's what I want to be for you. And if that means I have to die for this, I would sacrifice anything to see your faith just explode in Jesus and go big. I would give up my whole life to encourage you and to lift you up. Because I want you to share in that joy. I see joy in my sacrifice. And you should rejoice, and I'll share in your joy. And now we have a different cycle, a whole different paradigm. Instead of I deserve this, and if I get it, I'll be happy, it's I deserve nothing, but I would give up my whole life for you. And if you are raised up, that will make me happy. And when that cycle starts to happen, you share in my joy, and I share in yours. And we actually get to some satisfaction. We actually get some happiness in that relational context. This is great. Paul said, I'd even give up my whole life for that. And I know it seems counterintuitive that you'd give yourself up and that you would end up with joy, but that's actually how it works. And you might doubt that. You might stop and say, I don't know if that works. So I come back to the challenge at the beginning, and I want to ask you. I want to ask you to investigate your life a little bit and say, does the other way work? Does the entitlement way work? If I get what I want, I'll be happy. And then ask yourself, maybe this is a better way. Could this be a better way? That maybe that joy doesn't come from getting what I think I deserve, but sacrificing what I have for someone else. Some of us, honestly, we look at that and we go, oh, I don't want to. And then we're the whiner again, right? Now you're just complaining. Would you try it out? Would you test it? Here's why. This is the incredible thing I want to tell you about God that I think we don't see anywhere else in the world, any other philosophy, any other religion. I don't think you're going to see this. But everything that Paul has said here in these verses, this second part of chapter 2, comes on the back of the first thing that he said, the beginning of chapter 2. So just go back with me to verse 5 in Philippians chapter 2. This is amazing. Paul says, you must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. And then after that, what we'll read in the next minute is a song, what we think is a song from the early church. They probably wrote it based on their theology, what they believed about Jesus. And they would sing it when they got together, just like we sing songs together about Jesus based on what we believe. And so this is one of the earliest songs of the Christian church that Paul now quotes. And everything that we've said up to this point, don't do anything with grumbling, complaining. Live like children of God, not as the perverse, twisted generation, comes from what he teaches them here through this song that they probably already knew. Though he was God, speaking of Jesus, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Stop, circle it. Remember what I had you circle a second ago? Highlight on your app? Paul was saying, cling to the word of life. Cling to Jesus with both hands. Because Jesus, even though he was God, did not think that his equality with God, his position as God, was something to be grasped or to cling to and to hold on to. In other words, if you're clinging with both hands to what you think you deserve, you will have no hands to cling to Jesus. You need to release your entitlement so that you can grab onto Jesus with both hands and never, ever let go. Why? Because Jesus shows you that that's the way things work. We all know, anybody knows, if you believe in any kind of God, that God is powerful. It's one of the things that makes God God. God is powerful. He can do whatever he wants to do. We probably wouldn't call something God unless we believed that they were powerful. So many religions and philosophies will tell you that. Here, we see something we don't see anywhere else, that though he was God, he was powerful, he could do anything that he wanted, he did not consider equality with God, his position, something to cling to. God gave up his right to be God. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. It doesn't mean he stopped being God, but he gave up the privileges of that position. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. And when he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. God giving up the privileges of being God so that he could become a slave. Where have you ever heard that in your life? We all know that God is powerful, but what if God is sacrificially loving enough to empty himself of his privilege, of God himself, to take his hands off and stop clinging to his privileges and what he deserves? And if anybody deserves everything, it's Jesus. It says he didn't consider that something to cling to. Later, what we read, Paul says, now you cling to him. That's what you should cling to, not your entitlement, not to what you deserve. You cling to him because he let go of what he deserved to become a slave and to die for you. That's what God is like. He's that powerful that he could do anything. And he's that loving that he chose to use his power to sacrifice himself in love for you. What? That's what God is like. The one who's designed everything about this universe and about us chooses to give up what he's entitled to love us. Why would we cling to that? Because if that's how God works, if that's his design, then that's what we were designed for. If this is true. The way our relationships are supposed to work and the way that the world is supposed to work is that people are supposed to go, and let go of what I deserve, what I'm entitled to, even when I am entitled and deserve it. But I will find joy in sacrificing myself in love for other people, finding a way forward. I will let go of my entitlement so I can cling to Jesus. Because Jesus let go of his entitlement to cling to us. What an incredible love that is. You know, we don't just sing those songs. Just think of how incredible that is. Where have you ever heard anything like that? And verse 9 says, therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all other names, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue declare that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. God the Father endorsing Jesus and saying, that's exactly how I work. That's where glory comes from. That's where joy is found. That's everything. Paul goes, cling to that. Hey, if you're a Christian, there's no way to worship that God and not follow suit. There's no way to worship a God who does that and then to walk away and complain about what you're entitled to. I mean, there is a way because we do it. I mean, it doesn't make logical sense because when you get this, and we need to be reminded of this and always set it before us, it starts changes our heart and we go, oh, I realize that the way God works, therefore the way I ought to work, if I've fully realized my humanity in all its perfect forms, is by giving myself up, sacrificing myself for others. Listen, consumers complain and servants serve. and you get to choose which one you want to be. And I'm not going to stand up here and say, well, you just have to do this because that's what you're supposed to do. It's the moral thing to do. You have to as a Christian. I'm saying consumers, if that's your mindset, you're going to end up complaining. And I don't think that's ever going to bring you to a place of real satisfaction long term. Servants serve. Followers of Christ become servants. And as we serve, we find the joy of Christ, the joy that Paul was talking about, the joy that we now share in relationally. And that becomes our new paradigm, our new cycle. And that is just so, so powerful. So I'm just asking you to check it out and try it. For followers of Jesus, some of you, you know this. You go, oh man, I needed to be reminded of that. I need to be brought back to that because it's so easy to kind of just slide back to being a consumer and believing that, people are here for you and to serve you and to give you everything. And maybe even God is here to give you everything that you want. You go, oh wait, that's messed up. God relinquished his rights to cling to me. Now I get to do the same. So quick application. If you buy this, if you're willing to try it, I just simply ask you this. What's one thing that you can do this week to sacrifice your own wants to provide for someone else? Just think of something real practical. If you're married, there's about a billion examples that you could take up this week. You got housemates, co-workers, friends, you just be with people, you're going to find opportunities. Would you take that up and say, what's one thing where I can actually give something up? This might end up being financial. It might be your time. It might be a gift that you have, a skill that you have. You'll find the opportunities. Are you willing to sacrifice something in order to give somebody else? And my hope is that you try it once and maybe a second time, and maybe it bleeds into a third time, and maybe over time this becomes our mindset. People who follow Christ, when we get a real good look of what he was willing to give up for us, we go, man, there's so much joy in that. What could I give up for somebody else? To continue to challenge yourself, to take those opportunities, to make that be the paradigm of your life. We're going to finish with one more song, and as we do, just draw your attention to this. When we say, and Paul says, do everything without complaining, it's not that there aren't things to complain about. There are, and there are legitimate hurts and legitimate pains and things that shouldn't be in our lives. We wish they weren't there. It's not enough just to identify them. It's not that we complain about them. It's that we need to change the story of our life, the narrative that runs our life. And in this song, we're going to sing, some of the words go like this about Jesus, that the waves and winds still know his name. We believe God is that powerful, that Jesus could literally make the waves and the winds obey him because he is the creator, and that by him and through him, all things that are created were created, and that he sustains all things, and that he is God himself, and that he can do anything, that he is that powerful. And then the song says, but through it all, in the midst of whatever storm you have, whatever difficulties, whatever struggle you have, through it all, my eyes are on him. The one who used that power to sacrifice himself for us. And when you get that our God is that powerful and that our God is that loving, that you keep your eyes fixed on him, it's not that those things that you complain about just go away. It changes your paradigm. As the song says, and through it all, we're able to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. Because of who our God is. I invite you to that kind of peace today. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are as powerful as you are. Thank you that in your omnipotence and omniscience, you've used that power to lavish love upon us. Thank you that Jesus was willing to empty himself of his divine privilege, and that though he is God, didn't consider his privileges something to be grasped and held tightly to. Instead, he emptied himself of them so that he could cling on to us. Now, God, give us courage to do the same, to release what we think we're entitled to so that we can cling to you, to be servants as you've showed us, that love might characterize our life and be our joy, the joy that we find in you.